welcome to the program.
What age were you when you caught your first fish in this catchment?
In this catchment, I would have been about 12, I think.
Yeah.
But my very first fish, my dad tells me I was 4.
Really? Ken Whelan is one of the country's leading fisheries scientists, but he chose to meet me on the Boyne's major tributary, the Blackwater, for sentimental rather than scientific reasons.
My dad, my brother and myself, and we arrived at the bridge, Dunipatrick Bridge. We looked upstream and the river was lovely and brown, and I was only fishing maybe about 5 minutes and I caught my first trout. And I still remember we all gathered around the little trout before we put it back, because the river here is really rich, so the trout are really fat. And we were used to catching trout in the Dodder and in Wicklow, where they're handsome but they're quite thin. But these were like little barrels, and we were admiring this little fish in the landing net and then releasing it. And we had a great day that day. I don't know, we got 12 or 14 fish between us. It was a really good day.
Can you give me a map of this catchment?
It starts in County Kildare, and the interesting thing is that from top to bottom, it's flowing over limestone.
Kildare, Meath, Louth, there isn't so much as what you would dare to call a hill. So it's a pretty big, fat, slow, lazy river in most places.
Exactly, that's what it is. Yeah, it's a big, a bit like the Blackwater down south. You know, it's a big, majestic river. And even in the past, it was even slower. The great thing is that it wasn't dead in the sense it wasn't just without flow, but it was a very majestic flow, what we would call a glide. So it was gliding along.
The Boyne has changed profoundly since Ken first fished it. Drainage schemes, which have created lush, productive land for agriculture, have silted up much of the river, damaging it as a spawning ground for salmon and trout.
There was one particular event that I remember very, very clearly. It was just downstream of here. They had just set up the dynamite to blow out of the bed of the river, the actual limestone base of the river. And to get the gradient that they needed and to run the water free, they needed to take out this narrow in the river as such. And we stood there and watched it go up into the sky when they just blew the dynamite.
The slabs of limestone?
The slabs of limestone. We were way, way back and we just saw them, this huge big pall of smoke go up, and just these rocks and stone and everything else went up out of the bed of the river.
Did you have an emotional or a scientific reaction to that?
I had a highly emotional reaction, because I had stood on those flagstones and caught my very first fish on a dry fly, a mayfly, with my dad. And that was really emotional. And I've never forgotten, I have never fished the river since for that reason, because I was just so upset, you know.
This is your first day back here?
This is my first day back here since that time.
We created some very productive agricultural land as a consequence of that.
Well, I think I might argue that. That's probably true to some extent, but I have certainly seen situations where that has not been the case.
What you're describing to me there, though, is a tension between the productivity of the land and the health of the river. Is it reconcilable? Can it be put back into equilibrium?
Can I give you Ken Whelan's solution?
Okay.
My solution is, when you're speaking to the farmers, they're speaking about their assets and they're speaking about land. They're stewards of the land, but they're stewards of the water. We're getting very close to a situation now where we'll have to have areas where we can actually let rivers flood to slow the flow, to try and dampen down the effects of the floods. And again, that'll all be part of what I would consider this sort of stewardship package, this water stewardship package that we could discuss with farmers and see how it would work.
The salmon of knowledge, which Finn McCool burnt his thumb and gained the wisdom of the world from, was pulled from the Boyne. In recent years, we have gained knowledge of a new threat to the salmon population in the Boyne: the heat of the water. It's about 8 degrees today, and that's cold water there. It is hard to imagine the temperature of that water is causing a problem for the fish.
So whether it's trout or whether it's salmon, these creatures, they're seeking out cold, clean water. But the difference, if you had a situation where you had a drought, say, between June and July, and you came here in August with very low water conditions, it's extraordinary how much warmer that water can be.
How much warmer?
Well, we're looking at a situation where colleagues of mine have recorded running water temperatures of well over 20 degrees centigrade in Donegal.
20 degrees?
Centigrade.
That's
in Donegal.
Like a bath.
It is, absolutely a bath.
Is this just a piece of science that we're more sensitive or aware of now, or is this a feature of climate change?
Oh, this is absolutely a feature of climate change. And it's the it's not just the intensity of a particular event, but how long those events can actually last is also very worrying. And remember, we're not just concerned about the fish on their own. We have to think about the ecology of the river, because it's the ecology that's actually getting affected.
Is that bird on the other bank an egret?
Yes, it is. It's a little egret, because we have a great one too. They appeared only several years ago in Ireland just accidentally, but some of them stayed, and now they breed here. So they found their niche here. So they're not native, they're alien.
They're not native, but they found their niche here. Is this your spirit animal?
Yeah, maybe a little bit, yeah.
Gosia Wilkowska is a consultant ecologist originally from Poland who fell in love with the Boyne because it was both a nature and history-rich environment.
And I was fascinated by all the mythology connected with River Boyne and its impact on life around here.
Yeah. You must have thought, God, these people never stop telling stories around here.
That's very true, yes, but I love the stories, so I enjoy that.
She's a member of a voluntary group, the Boyne River Trust, who are working to restore the Boyne to good health. She has been taking the summertime temperatures of the upper stretches of the river and found them to be a lot higher than Ken Whelan had feared.
In some places, they can go nearly to 30 degrees, like in places where the water is very shallow and it's not shadowed by the trees.
30 degrees Celsius?
Yes.
Not Fahrenheit?
No, Celsius. But that's rather in up the stream in smaller tributaries. And so this would just spike during the day.
What happens when it gets to 30 degrees?
So all the species of both plants and animals are used to deal with these low temperatures, and some of them, especially salmonids, so salmon, trout and so on, they require cold waters for their development. So if it gets too warm, they just die at the young stages.
How do they die? What do they die from?
The warmer the water gets, the less oxygen is mixed in the water, so they can just suffocate.
Literally drowning in the river because of the heat.
You could say so, yeah.
But the Boyne River Trust have hit on a solution. Trees to provide shade from the sun. With help from the local authority waters programme, LawPro, they're growing trees in a nursery, 20,000 of them, from locally collected seeds that will then be planted along the upstream tributaries and spawning grounds. And where you have tree cover, what is the difference in temperature?
The difference is between the day and night. The environment then there is much more stable and much more suited for Irish wildlife.
And is it as simple as providing a canopy to stop the sunlight hitting the riverbed?
It's not only that. They have to be proper trees. And not only trees, but all the other plants living within the trees. So the so-called floodplain woodland or alluvial woodland. Here in Ireland, it should contain mostly ash, alder and willows. And they don't only provide shade, but also secure banks and slow down flooding in the springtime, and also slow down any runoff from the surrounding countryside, which allows for some filtration.
Not the first time we've heard how the right tree in the right place can solve a multitude of problems. I met Gosia, as she said, along the river walk in Navan, which is also
very near where Brenda met up with other Boyne River enthusiasts.
So we're right in the heart of the town. Like, it's busy around here. You can see lots of traffic and lots of people. We're just looking at the two rivers joining together. So the Boyne is coming up there from the right and turning around in that direction, and then the Blackwater's coming down then from the left and flowing all the way down then towards Stackallan and Slane.
Tina, wild about Navan, what is it about?
We're an urban nature conservation group, and what brings us together is that we're all from different backgrounds, different places, but we all live in Navan and we want to celebrate what's right here around us and find a way for all of us to protect it together.
I got involved because I wanted to make more friends, and honestly, I've made great friends, and we keep meeting absolutely brilliant, different, inspiring people of all ages. So that's been another really cool thing. It's like all of this idea of intergenerational. What can we learn from the people who are older and of Navan, and what do we teach the people who will be the future of Navan?
Coming from Finland, was it like a discovery as well when you found the river?
It absolutely was. To me, if the riverine habitat felt like just having a bit of home, you know, the green gold that we have in Finland, and it just felt like such freedom to be able to walk here and for the kids to run around and hear all the bird songs and see all the wildlife and watch the seasons change. It's absolutely beautiful.
Good, thanks. How are you guys?
At the ramparts, Tina and Emer meet up with Anina. She's the chairperson of Wild About Navan. She's brought along her 5.5-month-old baby girl, Alva. Isn't it extraordinary that in your group we have two people from Finland? Did you know each other beforehand, Tina?
No, we didn't. We don't know each other from Finland, but we actually did find each other in a Facebook group called Finns in Ireland. And Nina was posting about, are there any other Finns in Navan? And I said, well, I am actually. So we met up.
Before I moved to Navan, I lived by the coast pretty much all my life. But actually, walking by the river, I don't miss the sea at all. It's just such a great connection to nature. You can see the moorhens there, and the mallards are in the canal, feeding away. I've seen the otter twice. I call her Sophie because I've only seen her twice since always been by Sophie's Island. But yeah, we're a bit too late today in the day, I think, to spot the otter, but who knows?
It's actually beautiful, even though the weather is not great.
It's absolutely stunning. Yeah. I grew up learning about the River Boyne and from, I don't know what age I was, maybe 9 or 10, but I was always really excited about the, you know, the Salmon of Knowledge and Bowan. And now that I live in Navan, I'm not from Navan originally, I'm actually from Tullow in County Carlow. But I think, you know, standing beside the Boyne, I just kind of think of like the how ancient it is, how magic it is. I think of like all of our, you know, ancestors from so long ago. And the stories that we've created to kind of celebrate, you know, the folklore and the vibrancy of life over thousands of years.
So this here is Rowley's Lock. It's less than half an hour now from the car park. So it's, you know, if you're
we've
just
done
out
a good
for,
walk.
We have, Yeah. So Rowley's Lock, you can see there's the lock keeper's cottage. There's no roof on it. I really wish it was a cafe, but it's not. Here's a bench that, you know, we can sit on and look at the view. Since I've had the baby, the Rowley's Lock is pretty much halfway along the Navan Ramparts walk. So it's a great place to stop for a bit of breastfeeding, feed the baby and make sure that she's happy to keep going.
So if you just stop along here, this is where we usually manage to spot the kingfisher. So maybe if we just quieten down a little bit now and just spend a few minutes, sometimes up to 2 hours, but maybe we'll be a little bit luckier than that. So just have to quieten down and just see if we can see any type of blue kind of shimmer just coming out, but it'll be super fast, so you gotta be alert now.
I feel like I'm in the, you know, the Kit Kat ad with the two pandas.
Don't turn your back. Don't the roller skating back. Will begin.
Yeah.
The dancing pandas. Oh, I used to love that. But I love, a big fan of photography. I'm often out with my camera, but like they are just impossible to get a photograph of.
Do we call it a day?
Yeah, maybe we do. No, I think we might be out of luck today.
Now, there's a big problem in Ireland with rivers heating.
Look at the kingfisher.
Right, there you go.
Oh, lovely. Look at him.
Ah, beautiful.
Oh, he's beautiful.
Yes, I heard the little beep out of him. So yeah. Every time we hear that noise, we always swing our heads around. Where is he?
You have to be quick as well,
you
don't
do.
You?
You do. Isn't it a lovely thing to see?
Isn't it amazing?
There you go. Now, that'll make your day.
Sometimes, when you're not looking for something, it just lands in your lap. I was in a very different part of the Boyne catchment when that little arrow of blue darted through our legs. We were in the Knightsbrook River, which rises in Summerhill and joins the Boyne near Trim.
So, what are we looking at here, lads?
We've a little tributary coming into the Knightsbrook itself here. Now, there isn't an awful lot going on the bottom of the river in terms of substrate. There's not an awful lot of gravel.
Maureen and Robert Bergen are a husband and wife team with the Inland Fisheries. They wanted to show me the before and after of their efforts to improve the salmon numbers in the river.
Because there's no gravel there, salmon needs spawning gravel to spawn in every winter. And if it's not there, they can't spawn.
And if it's covered in silt.
Or not, just simply not there, it's washed away.
Okay.
So what happened, it's sort of an inevitable consequence of the process of arterial drainage. This entire catchment, almost the entire Boyne catchment, was drained in the late 60s and 1970s. And that involved straightening the river and deepening the river in order to alleviate flooding and to open up more agricultural land in the Midlands.
So we created some wonderful farmland here. We reduced the risk of flooding of urban areas and of people's land, but we didn't do the river any favours.
Exactly. Yeah, it absolutely devastated the fisheries habitat. So what happens is, as a result of the arterial drainage, we ended up with bits and pieces of gravel. Gravelled areas throughout the catchment, and so salmon were able to just cling on to those and have been spawning in those for the last few decades, and that's all they've been doing is surviving. But because the rivers are straightened and because they're confined within a channel, they're not able to do what rivers want to do, and that is that they want to burst out over to their banks and they want to burst their way through and create meanders and form a sinuous sort of a movement through the landscape and through the floodplain.
So does that mean, Robert, that if we're not prepared to allow the Boyne to wander wherever it wants, that you have to put gravel on the bed for the salmon to spawn on?
Well, that's the long and the short of it, I suppose, yeah, and that's what we're doing here. I'm lucky, or we're lucky, in that we're in fisheries about 30 years, so we can remember when this river was a very good spawning river. This was a very good nursery river. The stretch we're looking down at there, that 100 or 150 metres, if you were to come here on Christmas week 20 years ago, it would be dug over. And when I say dug over, I mean the salmon would be, adult salmon would be very actively digging reds to spawn. A red is where an excavation that the salmon makes to spawn into. Last winter we were here around Christmas week and I think we had 3 reds in that section there. So over the years it has really, really degraded.
So thousands of tons of gravel have been bought. A digger pressed into service. And at strategic points along the Knightsbrook, Maureen and Robert have dropped gravel onto the riverbed.
Are we okay to step in here?
Sure.
The entire riverbed here now is gravel as far as I can see, yeah?
Yeah, you can see it's very different to the place we came from, which is before the pre-work site. We're now at the post-work site, and you can see that it's wall-to-wall gravel.
And it's those little spaces between the stones that the salmon seek out, is it?
Exactly. As long as the gravel is loose, and they sweep their tails across the gravel, excavate a hole, lay their eggs, and their eggs drift back into the mound of gravel that we're standing beside here.
Again, if you look along that there, I was saying it was sinuous looking up along it, but a river sort of, it does 3 things. There's riffle, glide and pools. and you can see the riffles. We're standing in one now, and you can see the glides, the sort
the
of
smooth parts,
the smoother bits, and then there's a pool just there. It's not just a simple matter of throwing in gravel everywhere you like. It needs to go in these riffly areas, and you, as you can see there, that's exactly where they're spawning.
This means, though, that the river is effectively on a kind of a life support machine, though, doesn't it, Robert?
I suppose it does. It does. Well, hopefully we're the shot in the arm that it requires. I think we are. And if you look at the red counts for this over the last number of years, they were gone very poor. And this winter, I think on this man's farm alone, had we 47 reds. Yeah.
The highest red count that I ever got here in my 30-year career was 7. And it was up to 47 this year with all the new habitat given to it. But you're right, it is, unfortunately, it is something that we're going to have to just keep fixing and keep holding the river's hand to ensure the survival of the species.
Holding the river's hand, that's a nice way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, I hate that we have to do it, but that's where we are.
Stay with us as we follow the Boyne to Drogheda and explore an ancient slave cave and ask, could St. Patrick really have struck thousands dead in the Boyne Valley with a single look?
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
A very good morning and happy bank holiday weekend to you. This morning on Countrywide, we are doing another one of our river specials. We are navigating the surprisingly large Boyne River catchment from headwater to coast. If you see a river south of New Bliss in Monaghan, east of Mullingar in Westmeath, or north of Edenderry in Offaly, it will end up flowing into the Boyne. And that is why 334 years ago, in 1690, the deposed King James II decided that the south bank of the Boyne was the best natural feature in the landscape just outside Drogheda to try to use to halt the advance on Dublin of King William of Orange.
So much for making the trip, Ben.
All right.
Shall we do the names?
Jack, nice to meet you. Jack.
Rachel.
Ellie.
Jay.
Lee.
How many have you been here before?
Now, I know and you know how important the Battle of the Boyne is to Unionists and Loyalists of my age, 50s or older. But I was curious, did it still hold the same significance to Gen Z Unionists? So I persuaded five to take some time off university and make the trip south to the Republic's seventh most popular visitor attraction.
No, not one of you.
No. We don't even learn about this in school.
Yeah.
Well, I know
what?
I didn't. No, I don't know.
Are you kidding?
We learn about Nazi Germany, but not.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the visitor centre was closed by the time they arrived, so they had to make do with a bit of a cut-rate tourist guide.
See that tree over there?
Yes.
That is the battle oak. That was here 334 years ago. In fact, it was here a lot longer. It's about 500 years old. When you look at that and you think about what it witnessed, does anybody get that little bristle of hairs on the back of your neck?
Definitely, yeah. You know, this is the place that guaranteed us civil and religious liberties in such a huge way. And everything we know today in some way came from the spot.
Yeah.
It's, you can just feel like
do you?
Yes.
Do you have that connection,
yes,
with this spot, and it's doing that for you?
Yes.
Yeah? I'm assuming that you haven't visited too many other battle sites in the 26 counties. There's a big visitor centre here with a scrupulously fair and accurate history of this event. Does it matter to you that that kind of effort has been made?
It means a lot. Look, these are all really important efforts that I think everyone, both sides of the aisle here, can look at and go, that's good.
We can come down here as identifying Unionists, also identifying as just Northern Irish, and celebrate.
It's definitely, it's just more of a shared history kind of thing. We can't say that it's our history.
Only careful.
I'm holding it, sir.
You have a long journey home with wet feet if you get this wrong. You've got a rush of blood to the head.
We walk down from the battlefield to the river to thrash through the undergrowth in search of the spot where it's most likely that King Billy forded the Boyne.
It means something to you, obviously, because it makes you, like, hair stand up in the back of your neck, and you kind of, you can definitely feel like it obviously means something to you.
He had a personal guard of some 2,000 soldiers that he led somewhere really, really very close to us here, over there, and into history, as they say.
It is very surreal. I think that it's a lot to digest in one go.
Yeah, see, and what I'm trying to get a sense of really is how much this continues to matter within your generation of unionists.
For the longest time, we were sort of, there was a while there for about 20 years that we sort of distanced ourselves. I think that we're now beginning to reconnect.
But why? Do you understand why?
Because we were told that this was not okay to celebrate. This was not okay to commemorate. Now we've just accepted that that's wrong. Mm-hmm. That's wrong to think that you're not allowed to celebrate your own history.
I'm Ella McSweeney, and I've come to the village of Slane in Meath, where the River Boyne flows under a 13-arch bridge. Well, just beside it is a spot where generations of people have come to bathe and play in the water, but they're increasingly concerned about pollutants such as E. coli. Well, the EU's Bathing Water Directive could help them. If a site is officially designated, it means that the authorities are legally obliged to regularly test the waters and inform the public of the results. In France, 573 rivers are designated in this way. In Ireland, we have none. Well, local councillor Wayne Harding is pushing for the Boyne to become the first river in Ireland to gain EU bathing water status.
Well, my father is in his mid-80s, and he swam here, and I swam here. Now, we learned to swim here, which wasn't the right thing, but my children learned to swim in a safe environment, in a swimming pool, but they come here every summer. So I can easily say 100 years, that's without a doubt, because my father is 85 now.
And when did it start to change in terms of the water quality and concerns about what was in the water?
But recently, the last decade, maybe two decades, people talking about an effect on them if they swallowed gulps of water. And I think if you're talking to people locally, they can see, particularly river users, particularly the bathers, the kayakers, the fishermen, they're anecdotally reporting that the water quality is not what it was. And we know that. The results are there nationwide that our water courses are not as clean as they should be. A bathing status, obviously, it'll improve the testing. There'll be an onus on the local authority to publish the testing, but there will be an improvement in water safety as well.
Just explain a bit about this EU bathing water status. It's a piece of European water law. We apply it in coastal areas in Ireland and on lakes, but there is not one river yet in Ireland.
No, and which is hard to believe. And I've seen that it's all over Europe, and we should embrace it. This river is one of the most important in the country. Oscar Wilde's father wrote books about the beauty of the Boyne and the Blackwater. He said in his book that you can trace Irish existence on the island to the monuments that are along the River Boyne. Everything is here, and I do believe we have one chance at delivering the Greenway, and we should have little building blocks the whole way along the river. That includes bathing status at the bridge at Slane. If we're going to be serious about the environment, we need to embrace what's out there. Use it as a positive. Don't go, oh, what will we find? What's there? Make it cleaner.
Paul McGuire.
Nicola McGrain.
David Buckley.
Are you all from the Silverbridge Kayaking Club?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where's that based?
It works between Drogheda and Avon and environs. But we kayak here on the Boyne all the time. It's Lane.
This idea of getting EU bathing water status for this section of the river, would it have an impact on you?
I think this would be enormously attractive for us because we're on the water, we're in the water. If that water's clean, that's going to be fantastic. Unfortunately, the water has not been clean for the last number of years and people have sometimes been getting sick. I've been kayaking here for about 30 years. But currently, you can see items in the river that, would come from maybe the likes of sewage treatment plants or farm wash-off, that type of thing.
David, does that sound familiar to you?
Quite common that over the years you hear of people getting sick here and there. And as Paul said, you do drink quite a lot of water, regardless whether you want to or not. Yes.
Yeah. What kind of changes have you seen on the Boyne?
During the summer months when there's not a lot of water running through the river, it leaves lots of stagnant pools in between. If there's pollution coming down and if the river's not well oxygenated, it can get a little bit smelly and a little bit disgusting during the really low water periods.
And David said there's lots of new people on the river. You're one of them, aren't
you? Yeah, so I'm a new member to the club and I would get a lot more confidence going down the river if I thought that the water was clean and safe. I spend a lot of time swimming in it. Obviously, you just like to know that it's clean. I swim in the sea sometimes as well, and you can check some of the bathing sites and you can check what the water status is like there. You don't know here.
There's massive interest. It is a great natural local amenity, and it really needs to be taken better care of.
So when did you find this?
So I think in 2008. Good. So it's, do you want me to open it up?
Yeah, please.
So as you can see, there's a kind of a passage.
Oh, we have to go down.
Yeah.
We go down.
Of course, yeah.
This is very famous five, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just a few miles downstream of Slane, Jack Rogers found out just how much history there is on the banks of the River Boyne when a truck sank into a hidden souterrain, an ancient tunnel, on his farm.
Oh,
they were small, whoever crawling around in this.
Okay. And effectively, this would have been a souterrain for a promontory fort, the Kingdom of Brega, that was set on top of Nowth.
Okay, so what does a souterrain do?
I suppose, and my limited understanding is it was for storage of foodstuffs. It was for safety. You could go into it and hide. And I don't know, some people don't like me saying this, but you might even keep your slaves in it, you know?
Ooh.
That hand of history on his shoulder was one of the things that encouraged Jack to change direction on the farm and move from quite an intensive operation on the banks of the river into the National Parks and Wildlife Service farm plan, which compensates him for reducing his stock.
You're looking at the bend in the Boyne, and some would say that the salmon of knowledge was caught in at the other side.
Some would say.
I think there's a lot of salmon of knowledge caught in various places around the country. But
fisherman's tales, yeah.
But it is, you know, you're talking about a landscape that has huge significance in Irish folklore. You know, we're lucky to be able to live and work beside it.
I would imagine that also brings a certain sense of responsibility with it as a farmer as well.
Yeah, well, you want to farm in a way that respects the place. And, you know, I've always loved this place as a child. And my mother has a particular love of it. And that's why we kind of went into the farm plan. It's great to see all the different things and actually becoming engaged with what's on your doorstep, you know.
But what differences, what changes has it forced on you? Like 20 years ago, what was your stocking rate by comparison to now?
We would have had about 40 cows on this and all their calves and a bull, and it would have been grazed quite tight. We reduced the stocking density down to maybe only 17 or, you know, 20 heifers. And then at one point we actually stopped grazing it all together and it kind of rewilded. And at that point then we started getting in animals again, and it was in 2021 that I saw the farm plan advertised by National Parks and Wildlife Service, and behind my father's back went and applied. And which he wasn't against at all, but he, you know, it was kind of at that point, it was like, right, we got this beautiful natural resource on our doorstep. How can we get a benefit from it while also managing it in a way that's good for it?
Has it hit that sweet spot then where you feel you're being properly compensated for reducing the stock to a density that is sympathetic to the landscape?
The jury's still out. I'm still trying, not in a negative way, I'm just still trying to feel my way through this.
Well, you wouldn't want to make a snap judgment, obviously.
No, and we're only in our second year of doing it. But I like the concept of results-based farm schemes. You do something, you get paid for them. And that's what we're doing.
But that very basic equation of, yeah, okay, I'll farm for nature, but pay me, please. That, you think that that's working?
Yeah, I think it is. Like, it's given it a purpose. You know, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't giving some sort of return. And now it's just about figuring out how to make it work. You know, to basically iron out the small creases, mm-hmm. you know. There will always be commercial farming. But it's needed to feed people. But for very specific areas and specific habitats, I think this is definitely the way forward. And you have, at the bottom, there was a couple of houses in the cover. Ooh.
As we walked through his fields on the bank of the river, we started chatting about the World War One poet Francis Ledwidge, who lived just a few miles upriver. As coincidence would have it, before he was killed in action in 1917, he wrote a poem about Jack's farm.
Our clouds that change and pass, and stars that shine a while, dew water on the grass, a fox upon a stile, a river broad and deep, a slow boat on the wave, my sad thoughts on the sleep that hollows out the graves.
And that was written about this house and this
farm?
Well,
it's called Crewbawn, yeah, C-R-E-W-B-A-W-N.
He lived only 3 miles back in the road.
He would have been literally stomping all over this place, you know. He would have been, you know, walking everywhere.
That river, broad and deep, moves ever east, past Nowth, Douth and Newgrange, under the Mary McAleese Bridge, through Drogheda, and meets the sea at Mornington. And it is there that our patron saint entered the mouth of the Boyne on his way a millennium and a half ago to light the paschal fires on the Hill of Slane that would put him on a collision course with the Druids and Ireland on the path to Christianity. Or did he? Local historian and mythical Ireland tour guide Anthony Murphy told me that you're always on shaky ground with Patrick and facts.
He stopped here on his way up to the north. He met a Druid here who was displeased with the whole idea of Christianity, and Patrick blessed the place, and apparently the earth swallowed the Druid whole.
Which, when you look at the kind of boggy nature of the area around us, doesn't sound completely impossible.
Yeah, could be anywhere under our feet. But when Patrick came back down from Ulster, he came to the Boyne Estuary again. And when I bring visitors to Slane in particular, I talk about how there was a strategy behind the lighting of the paschal fire on the Hill of Slane. First and foremost, the strategy was to do so in full view of the king and, you know, the pagan political centre of Ireland at Tara, which is only, you know, 10 miles to the south from Slane and visible. But also, you know, if you turn your gaze eastwards from Slane, you see the great monuments of Bru na Bonaia. And of course, in the tripartite life, it is specifically said that he chose Maibray, or the plain of Brega, because of its association with idolatry and paganism. So there was a clear strategy at work here.
Kings to the left of him, pagans to the right of him, and he was figuratively flicking two fingers in both directions.
I think so. I think that's quite clear. And if you read now, look, I hope this doesn't offend any of your listeners, but I'm an agnostic and raised as a Catholic. For me, much of what is written about St. Patrick is fable. It's very mythological, you know, and he appears to repeat some of the feats of the earlier pagan heroes, and the way he strides in off the islands, off Skerries, sounds very much like something Finn McCool was doing.
If we leave aside the snakes and jumping across several miles of water in a single stride, if we leave all of that out of the equation, the lighting of the fires is historical fact, is it?
Well, no.
Ah, okay.
I'm not so sure. The story of Patrick is at least suspicious. Did you know, for instance, that when Patrick finally made it to Tara, having lit the Paschal fire and subdued the druids who came to Slane to attack him, that he made 12,000 people drop dead all at once at Tara, according to the tripartite life?
No, this was strangely not what is talked about when we think about Patrick.
No.
Can we say with any certainty that he did sail past us on this little stretch of water here and put in at this point on the Boyne?
I don't believe we can say that with certainty. It's been said that the known facts about Patrick could be written on the back of a postage stamp, but the legendary material about him fills many volumes.
Anthony Murphy of Mythical Ireland. It would have been nice for the weekend that's in it to end our journey down the Boyne, certain that I was now walking in St. Patrick's footsteps. But it kind of misses the point when you think about how many others have used or been inspired by the Boyne. The High Kings, the Druids, Oliver Cromwell, King Billy, Francis Ledwidge, William Wilde, and the scores who today continue to take so much pleasure from it. This has been a fascinating journey. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll do another river soon. In the meantime, have a great weekend.